Fellow Christians from all over the world, on an occasion like this, when I would wish of all things to be concerned only with what I have to say, rather than with how I say it or the response to how I say it, the greatest enemy is my own public or televisual person. This deplorable character has a quite disgraceful interest in being funny, saying what passed for being clever things, and so on. How closely I have myself been identified with this lamentable figure has recently been brought home to me in a very vivid way, because there is a man on British television who imitates me. A man called Mike Yarwood. Now, what is so humiliating is that a great many people think that I have been appearing on television. This unhappy plight was further brought out when, some little while ago, there was a sort of contest in a newspaper. A list of names was given, and the readers had to say who among them were real people and who were fictional characters. I had the very creditable score of 61% who thought I was a real person. I may say I was well ahead of the Reverend Ian Paisley. The trouble is, you see, that one has this fancy for making an impression for its own sake. And it is my dearest wish that that should be totally absent from my mind and my heart tonight. Cheers, you know, have an alluring sound, but what evokes them is usually fraudulent. Truth is quiet and solitary, not noisy and collective. It doesn't need to be topped up by celebrity or reinforced by numbers. There's a saying of Kierkegaard's that I like very much. He says, 10,000 men shouting the same thing makes it false, even if it happens to be true. So, when I try to make myself think only of what is to be said, I've got three little prayers that I nearly always say over to myself. And if you'll forgive me, tonight I'll say them aloud. The first one is written by myself. It's the only prayer I've ever written, and so I can legitimately, without immodesty, quote it. I found it scribbled in the flyleaf of a book dated from Salem, Oregon, April 7, 1968. Why I should have been in Salem, Oregon then, where Salem, Oregon is, I haven't a clue. The second one is from the prologue to a book that I love very dearly, The Cloud of Unknowing. And the last is by Augustine. So may I say those three brief prayers. The first one, O God, stay with me. Let no word cross my lips that is not your word. No thought enter my mind which is not your thought. No deed ever be done or entertained by me that is not your deed. Then from the Cloud of Unknowing, God, unto whom all hearts be open, and unto whom all will speaketh, and unto whom no privy thing is hid, I beseech thee, so for to cleanse the intent of mine heart with the unspeakable unspeakable gift of thy grace, that I may perfectly love thee and worthily praise thee. And finally, by Augustine, let me offer you in sacrifice the service of my thoughts and my tongue, but first give me what I may offer you. Now, having tried to prepare myself, I proceed to my address, which I have called Living Through an Apocalypse. And the subject seemed rather appropriate when I thought of coming to Lausanne, because in Lausanne I always think of a very corpulent, not to say obese, Englishman named Edward Gibbon, who some two centuries ago was settled here to complete his majestic work, A History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, a great masterpiece, written with all the elegance and detachment which characterized the 18th century mind. It's only fair to add that his detachment, if not his elegance, deserted him when he was confronted not with the breakdown of this ancient civilization across the centuries, but with actual disorders near at hand, consequent upon the revolutionary situation that had arisen in France. What might permissibly be regarded as the first shot in a process fated to submerge the civilization Gibbon himself belonged to, and that he so rejoiced in and regarded as the acme of all human achievement. We're all, I think, a little like this, and easily endure the troubles of the past while beating our breasts lustily over those of our own time. Even so, I want to say to you, boldly, plainly, that it has long seemed to me clear, beyond any shadow of doubt, that what is called Western civilization is in an advanced stage of decomposition, and that another dark age will soon be upon us, if indeed it hasn't already begun. With the media, especially television, governing all our lives as they indubitably do, it's easily imaginable that this might happen without our noticing. I was reading the other day about a distasteful but significant experiment that was being conducted in some laboratory or other. A number of frogs were put into a basin of water, and the water very gradually raised to boiling point, with the result that they all expired without making any serious effort to jump out of the dish. Now, the frogs are us, and the water is our habitat. And the media, by accustoming us to the gradual deterioration of our values and circumstances, ensure that boiling point comes upon us unawares. It's my own emphatic opinion that boiling point is upon us now, and that as a matter of urgency, Christians must decide how they should conduct themselves in face of so apocalyptic a situation. Now, as I well know, to talk in this strain is to invite the accusation of pessimism. In my opinion, the boot is quite on the other foot. If I ridicule a prospectus for building a housing estate on the slopes of Mount Etna, I'm not being a pessimist. On the contrary, it's the advocates of this ruinous and ridiculous project who are the true pessimists. And to warn against it and denounce it is optimistic, in the sense that it presupposes the possibility of building a house on secure foundations, as it's put in the New Testament, on a rock, so that when floods arise and streams beat violently against it, it stands firm. In other words, what I'm trying to say is this, that the most pessimistic attitude anyone could possibly take today would be to suggest that a way of life based on materialist values, on laying up treasure on earth in the shape of an ever-increasing gross national product, and a corresponding ever-increasing consumption, stimulated and fostered by the fathomless imbecilities of advertising, could possibly provide human beings made in the image of their creator, sojourners in time but belonging to eternity, with a meaningful basis for existence. So, each symptom of breakdown, however immediately painful and menacing in its future consequences, is also an occasion for hope and optimism, reminding us that indeed God is not mocked, and that men can no more live without reference to him now than could the children of Israel find their way to the promised land without his guidance and support. I'd like to describe to you a scene that stayed in my memory, but that bears on this point. I was in a New York television studio with Mother Teresa, of whose work in Calcutta I'm sure you will have heard, for one of those morning interviews, you know, which help Americans to munch their breakfast cereal and swallow their coffee. It was the first time that Mother Teresa had ever been in an American television studio, so she was totally unprepared for the constant interruptions for commercials. This particular morning, as it happened, the commercials were all to do with different sorts of packaged food, commended to viewers as non-fattening and non-nourishing. I saw Mother Teresa looking with a kind of wonder at this screen. Could this really be true? Was this really what was being shown to people? Of course, you will recognize that her own constant preoccupation is to find the wherewithal to nourish the starving and to put some flesh on human skeletons. So that the notion of going to great expense and trouble to persuade people to eat bread whose prime quality was that it didn't nourish struck her as the most astonishing thing. It took a little while for the irony of the situation to get her. And when it did, she remarked in a quiet but perfectly audible voice, "I see that Christ is needed in television studios." A total silence descended on the studio, and I fully expected the lights to go out and the floor manager to be struck dumb, if not fall dead. After all, a word of truth had been spoken in one of the mills of fantasy, where the great 20th century myth of happiness successfully pursued is fabricated. It was an unprecedented occurrence. Actually, as the commercial was running, we weren't on the air, and the impact of Mother Teresa's striking interruption was soon spent. Even so, I felt that in the Book of Life, if not in the New York Times, it would rate a mention. Now, what I'm trying to say to you is that in many ways, crack-up conditions are more conducive to the understanding and practice of our Christian religion than ostensible stability and prosperity. After all, the Apostle Paul's amazingly successful evangelism took place during the reign of the Emperor Nero, a ruler who makes even some of ours seem positively enlightened and far-seeing. Moreover, the early Christians had the inestimable advantage of believing that the world would shortly come to an end, a belief that, as Dr. Johnson said, at the prospect of being hanged, wonderfully concentrates the mind. The ill consequences, anyway, of the opposite proposition, today's dogma, that the world goes on indefinitely, in the process getting better and better, are all too apparent. Sooner or later, the world must end anyway, whereas the utopias men persuade themselves are just round the corner never even, properly speaking, begin, whether they are realized through the final installation in power of a triumphant proletariat, or through the fulfillment of an American dream of eternally burgeoning health, wealth, and happiness, or whatever. Just think of the advantages the early Christians derived from their conviction that the last days would soon be upon them. For one thing, they were spared the illusory hopes in revolution and counter-revolution, in insurrection and liberation and conspiracies, which then, as now, abounded. Who would throw his heart into proposing the nationalization of the trams if he knew that the last days would soon be arriving? What a delightful relief when you think of the various projects that are put before us by our politicians, that we could smile at them all and dismiss them from our minds. You see, with thoughts of an imminent apocalypse, who would bother his head unduly about such delectable promised future developments as supersonic flight, computerized literature, birth pills for tiny tots, or transplant surgery with a view to changing our spare parts as they wear out, and so keeping us on the road indefinitely, like poor old vintage cars? What a blissful relief it must have been for the early Christians to turn away from the capers of an Emperor Nero and the turgid rhetoric of his critics, and joyously await the promised coming of their Lord and Savior. You know, it really almost looks to me as though the best hope of revivifying institutional Christianity would be to convince the ecclesiastical brass, I mean the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Metropolitan Nicodeme and other dignitaries, that the world will shortly come to an end. It might, of course, be better, it would certainly be easier, to get the World Council of Churches to pass a resolution in this sense at its next meeting. No, it's in the breakdown of power that we can discern its true nature, see the skull beneath the skin, and realize that what the devil offered Jesus in the wilderness, the kingdoms of the earth, to do what he liked with, was, like all the devil's propositions, a fraudulent one. On the other hand, it's when power seems strong and speaks with a firm voice that we're most liable to be taken in. And suppose that it really can be used to advance human freedom and well-being. Forgetful that Jesus is the prophet of the loser, not the victor's camp, proclaiming that the first will be last, that the weak are the strong, and the fools the wise, that the poor and lowly, not the rich and proud, possess the kingdom of heaven. Let us then, as Christians, rejoice that we see around us on every hand the decay of the institutions and instruments of power, on every hand intimations of empires falling to pieces, money in total disarray, dictators and parliamentarians alike nonplussed by the confusion and conflicts which encompass them, and the very weaponry at their disposal so monstrous in its destructiveness as to be unusable except to blow our very earth and all its creatures to smithereens. Confronting this scene, it is, I confess, sometimes difficult to resist the conclusion that Western man has decided to abolish himself, creating his own boredom out of his own affluence, his own vulnerability out of his own strength, his own impotence out of his own erotomania, himself blowing the trumpet that brings down the walls of his own city, and having convinced himself that he's too numerous, laboring with pill and scalpel and syringe to make himself fewer, until at last, having educated himself into imbecility and polluted and drugged himself into stupefaction, he keels over, a weary, battered old brontosaurus, and becomes extinct. Here I speak with some feeling, since it's through a realization of the fantasies of power that I've come to recognize the irresistible truth of the gospel of love that Jesus came into the world to expound. The trade of journalism, which I've followed for something like half a century, is calculated to induce this awareness. Who can be engaged in the quest for news without realizing that what he purveys bears as little a relation to what is really happening in the world as Muzak does to music? Indeed, the two, Muzak and what might be called Newsak, are decidedly similar, the one being a drooling mélange of tunes and the other a drooling mélange of ostensible events, both calculated to keep the mind of a motorist in a suitable condition of somnolent vacancy as he cruises mile after mile along the motorways. How many liberations celebrated that only led to new servitudes? How many reigns of peace ushered in that only generated new wars? How many liberators installed in power only to become even more ferocious tyrants than those they replaced? The splendid words of the Magnificat go on being fulfilled. The mighty are put down from their seats, and the humble and meek exalted. The hungry are filled with good things, and the rich sent empty away. Yes, but how soon, how very soon, the humble and meek who've been exalted become mighty, and in their turn fit to be put down. How quickly the poor who've been filled with good things become rich, thereby likewise qualifying to be sent empty away. My earliest memories of this public scene is of the First World War, which I was given to understand was a war to end war and make a world fit for heroes to live in. God, I gathered, was on our side, and when victory was achieved, his spokesman turned out to be Woodrow Wilson, who in Princetonian accents delivered to us 14 points as Moses had 10 commandments. Four more for Wilson. Later, in the columns of the old Manchester Guardian, I thundered away about how the League of Nations would ensure peace forevermore if only everyone would disarm and institute free education for all and universal suffrage democracy. As the events of the interwar years unfolded, it was borne in upon me that the governments of the world were failing to follow this enlightened advice, and that insofar as they had followed it, the results were far from edifying. Jesus, I was brought up to believe, was a most high-minded and altogether estimable man, who, if not actually a paid-up member of the British Labour Party, would have been if a Labour Party had existed in Palestine in his time. By setting up a welfare state in accordance with Labour Party policy, dismantling the British Empire, and otherwise reforming our capitalist imperialist ways, we should effectively bring his kingdom to pass. Whereas, through the centuries of Christendom, it had been relegated to celestial regions, thereby inducing the downtrodden and oppressed to be content with their lot. Alas, the Labour Party in due course was in a position to form governments, but Jesus' kingdom seemed as far off as ever. It presented us first with Ramsay MacDonald and then with Harold Wilson, who, no doubt estimable men, could scarcely be regarded as the kingdom of God. As for the dismantled British Empire, its liberated components tended to become mirror images of the authoritarian regimes which had been dispossessed. It was business as before under local management. It's difficult to resist, in the light of these thoughts, it's difficult to resist the conclusion that the only causes, the only earthly causes with which the name of Jesus may safely be associated are those with a built-in, certified guarantee that they cannot possibly triumph. Feeling thoroughly disheartened and disillusioned, I directed my hopes for a better world towards the USSR, where the then Dean of Canterbury, Dr. Hewlett Johnson, regularly proclaimed from his cathedral pulpit, Stalin was busily constructing the kingdom of Christ. At the time, the dean was commonly regarded as rather a buffoon. On the contrary, he's proved to be something of a pace setter and would find himself today very much at home among large numbers of his fellow clergy. Managing to get myself posted to Moscow as a newspaper correspondent, it didn't take long to realize that far from giving a new validity to liberty, equality, and fraternity, the Soviet regime was rapidly turning into one of the most absolutist tyrannies of history, presided over in the person of Stalin by one of its most cruel and obscurantist tyrants. The only original feature, as compared with other tyrannous regimes in the past, was that for some bizarre reason, it met with the unstinted approval of the flower of our Western liberal intelligentsia, who, as long as it was humanly possible, went on applauding each restriction of liberty, each brutal suppression of dissidents, which at home their lives were dedicated to upholding. Therefore, I had no expectation thenceforth whatsoever that man could perfect his own circumstances and shape his own destiny. I found myself echoing words of Pascal. It is in vain, O men, that you seek within yourselves the cure for your miseries. Your principal maladies are pride, which cuts you off from God, and sensuality, which binds you to the earth. Either you imagine your gods yourselves, or if you grasp the vanity of such a pretension, you are cast into the other abyss. And suppose yourselves to be like the beasts of the field, and seek your good in carnality. So, without God, we were left with the choice of megalomania or erotomania, the clenched fist or the phallus, Nietzsche or Sartre, Hitler or D.H. Lawrence. Meanwhile, I managed to sleepwalk my way through the Second World War and its aftermath, increasingly conscious that this weird human scene I had to go through the motions of reporting and commenting upon and interpreting, and its dramatis personae of men seeking power with a view, as they all insisted, to promoting the public good, belonged rather to fantasy than to reality. In a way, I found it easier to cope with it as editor of Punch than at what passed for being serious journalism. Except that, in trying to ridicule those, as the Book of Common Prayer puts it, set in authority over us, one was constantly frustrated because, as it turned out, they were themselves, in what they said and did and were, infinitely more absurd than one's wildest imaginings. This was an extremely frustrating experience, and it applied particularly, I may tell you, to the clerical echelons, whose strange gyrations were the envy and despair of professional humorists. What satirical invention, I ask you, could hope to equal a bishop in gaiters appearing in a court of law to testify that Lady Chatterley's lover was a representation of Christian marriage at its best? Or a dialoguing Jesuit looking for common ground between the Sermon on the Mount and the Communist Manifesto, like I used to reflect an ardent vegetarian exploring the possibility of teaming up with the worshipful company of butchers. Or a priestly dispenser of gelignite to freedom fighters, as representing the readiest means of manifesting how they love their enemies and seek the good of those who persecute them. The fact is that the pursuit, the quest for power itself, is a deadly serious one. Dictators, like brothel keepers, abominate laughter, which the saints have all loved, hearing it ringing out from heaven itself, louder sounding when heaven's gates swing open, abating and dying away as they swing too. The same impulse which led the builders of the medieval cathedrals as marvelous monuments to our religion to include in them both steeples and gargoyles. Steeples climbing up into the sky, representing man's insatiable aspiration to reach after his God, and gargoyles looking down at the earth and seeing in human life itself the same disparity between human aspiration and human achievement. Shakespeare makes his King John refer to that idiot laughter, a passion hateful to my purposes, thereby speaking on behalf of all power maniacs at all times. In this sense, power mania is a sort of pornography of the will, corresponding to the other sort, equally humorless, of the flesh. When the Roman soldiers played their sick joke on Jesus, dressing him up in a scarlet robe, putting a crown of thorns on his head, bowing low before him in mock reverence as King of the Jews, they were not, as they supposed, just ridiculing a poor, deluded man about to die, but holding up to ridicule all kings, all rulers, all exercises of authority, whoever had been or were to be. They were making power itself derisory, ensuring that henceforth we should see thorns beneath every crown, and beneath every scarlet robe, whoever was wearing it, stricken flesh. Now, the only alternative I could discover in my weird trade to the ultra-solemn quest for power was Jesus' ultra-joyous quest for love. But I confess I did everything in my power to evade it. Contrary to what is often suggested, a hedonistic way of life, if you have the temperament for it and can earn a living at it, is perfectly feasible. The earth's sounds and smells and colors are very sweet. Human love brings golden hours. The mind at work gives great delight. Unfortunately, however, I was driven to the conclusion that something was lacking in the hedonistic setup. Some essential ingredient, something I vaguely glimpsed, but whose lack made everything else seem somehow savourless. The words that most often sounded in my ears were Peter's reply on behalf of the 12, when Jesus asked them whether they too proposed to desert him. "Lord, to whom shall we go? Thou hast the words of eternal life. If only there had been someone else, some other words, some other way, how eagerly I should reveal myself. But there weren't, and there aren't." Let me try and tell you how I came to see the situation I was in a sort of dream or vision or idea, anyway, something that lived with great vividness and actuality in my mind, more so than many happenings and experiences. I'm confined in the tiny dark dungeon of my ego, a small dark space, manacled with the appetites of the flesh, shackled with the inordinate demands of the will, a prisoner serving a life sentence without hope of deliverance. Then I notice that high above me there's a window through which a faint glow of light comes filtering in, seemingly so far away, so remote and inaccessible. Yet, I realize, a window looking out onto eternity. Inside, darkness, a place of fantasies and furies. Outside, the white radiance of God's love filling the universe. What the Apostle Paul calls the glorious liberty of the children of God. Only lasting and authentic liberty there is for men in this world. And the window. What's the window? Well, I find I know what that is too. It's the incarnation. It's time and eternity intersecting in a cross. It's now becoming always. It's God revealing himself as a man and reaching down to us, in order that we, reaching up, may relate ourselves to him. Now I observe that the window is not, after all, far away, but near at hand. And that seen through it, everything makes sense. As it were, you know, when you're working in a film, comes into sync. So that like the blind man whose sight Jesus restored, I can say, one thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see.
Thenceforth, whenever I'm looking through the window, I see life as full of joy and hope and brotherliness. Whereas the moment I turn away, the darkness encompasses me again. The ego once more lifts up its cobra head. The servitude to the appetites and the will resumes. I'm back in prison. Through the window, in other words, I look out on reality. Within, there's only fantasy. And oh, the glory of reality, the horror of fantasy, the one heaven, the other hell. Two states as clearly differentiated as are light and darkness, joy and wretchedness, life and death. Nothing, Simone Weil writes, is so beautiful and wonderful. Nothing is so continually fresh and surprising, so full of sweet and perpetual ecstasy as the good. No desert is so dreary, monotonous, and boring as evil. But with fantasy, it's the other way around. Fictional good is boring and flat, while fictional evil is varied and intriguing, attractive, profound, and full of charm. Blake was making the same point when he wrote, "This life's dim windows of the soul distorts the heavens from pole to pole and leads you to believe a lie when you see with, not through the eye." He might have been predicting the coming of television, which preeminently requires us to see with rather than through the eye. And what a multitude and variety of lies it's induced belief in. I want to conclude by recounting briefly two recent experiences which seem to me significant in relation to what I've been talking about. Both occurred in the course of preparing the commentaries for a series of religious documentary films. In the first case, I found myself standing amidst the ruins which are all that now remains of Carthage, and trying to relate and reconstruct the scene there when, in the year 410, the Bishop of Hippo, better known as St. Augustine, heard the news that Rome had been sacked. For him, it was the end of civilization and of the world as he'd known it. A world in many respects uncannily like ours. A world dropping to pieces. A world full of contradictions and confusion and conflicts. Don't hold on to the old man, the world. Don't refuse to regain your youth in Christ, who says to you, "The world is passing away. The world is short of breath. Don't fear. Thy youth shall be renewed as an eagle." And then he devoted the remaining 17 years of his life to the deeper question of the relation between earthly cities like Rome, which men build and destroy, and the city of God, which is everlasting, embodying his conclusions in his great work, The City of God, which defined for successive generations of Christians what they owed to God and what to Caesar. Now I move on through 15 centuries and stand beside Tolstoy's grave at Yasnaya Polyana in Russia, where he lived. As Augustine held the secret of what would follow the fall of Rome, so I had somehow the feeling that what lay ahead for us might be sought here, where Tolstoy was buried, at the edge of a ravine and looking over a forest, with no monument or memorial, just as he'd wished it to be. simply a mound of earth piled high with flowers. Speaking about him in that place, as I did for the commentary, about his beautifully lucid exposition of the Gospels, about his incomparable short stories, parables like Jesus's, about his distrust of all governments, all systems of power, as instruments for ameliorating our human condition, was one of the most enchanting experiences of my life. The words were addressed only to a camera and a camera crew, along with one or two Russian helpers. But they seemed to fly into the clear September air and lose themselves among the silver birches like joyous birds. I thought of Russia's 50 years or more of ruthlessly authoritarian rule, reaching into every aspect of the lives of those subjected to it, into their work and their play and their education, into their innermost thoughts and hopes, and of how this immense apparatus of power, probably the greatest ever to exist in the world, had been dedicated to the extirpation of the Christian religion and all its works, and of how nonetheless, through the genius of Tolstoy, Jesus' message, the enchantment of his words and presence, what he came into the world to do and say and suffer, had remained accessible. For confirmation, we have Solzhenitsyn, the Soviet regime's foremost rebel, who so brilliantly and forcefully challenges its pretensions, not in the name of freedom or democracy or of any of the 20th century's counterfeit hopes, but of his Christian faith, with its insistence on the absolutes of love rather than the relativities of justice, on the universality of brotherhood rather than the particularity of equality, on the perfect freedom, which is service, rather than the perfect service, which is freedom. The odds against its happening were astronomical, but it's happened. If, when I was a journalist in Moscow, someone had said to me that the most distinguished Russian writer, a product of the Soviet regime, will write, as Solzhenitsyn has, and I quote, "I myself see Christianity today as the only living spiritual force capable of undertaking the spiritual healing of Russia." If anyone had predicted that would be said by such a one as Solzhenitsyn, I would have given 1,000, 1,000,000 to 1 against. Yet it's happened, and surely it's a miracle, and one of the greatest. Now I conclude. For me, the experience of living in this world is nearly over. My lines, such as they are, have been spoken. My entrances and my exits have all been made. It's a prospect, I'm thankful to say, that I can face without panic, fear, or undue remorse. Confident that, as an infinitesimal part of God's creation, I am a participant in his purposes, which are loving, not malign, creative, not destructive, orderly, not chaotic. And that, however somberly at times the darkness may lower, and however men may seem at times to prefer the darkness, the light that first came to Galilee 2,000 years ago and through the succeeding centuries has illumined all that was greatest in the work and lives of men can never be put out. The other day there was published in English almost the last words Tolstoy wrote And they too were about this light. And he concluded, "This is what I have wanted to say to you, my brothers, before I died." I echo his words.